Thank you for downloading this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. CFR is an independent national membership organization and nonpartisan research center. For more information, please visit us online at cfr.org.
Good afternoon from New York, and welcome to this Council on Foreign Relations, Religion, and Foreign Policy conference call. I am Irina Faskanis, Vice President for the National Program and Outreach here at CFR. As a reminder, today's call is on the record, and the audio will be available on our website, www.cfr.org. We're delighted to have Elliot Abrams with us to discuss the current state of the Israeli-Palestinian peace process. Mr. Abrams is Senior Fellow for Middle Eastern Studies at CFR. Prior to coming to CFR, he served as Deputy Assistant to the President and Deputy National Security Advisor in the Bush administration, where he supervised U.S. policy in the Middle East. He is currently a member of the United States Commission on International Religious Freedom and serves on the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Council. Mr. Abrams is the author of four books, the most recent of which is entitled Tested by Zion, the Bush Administration and the Israeli-Palestinian Conflict, which was released in 2013. Additionally, he writes the CFR blog Pressure Points, which focuses on U.S. policy in the Middle East. Elliot, thanks very much for being with us today. Given all your experience, it would be great if you could talk about what you see as the status of the negotiations and your policy recommendations for how the United States can move the process forward.
Thanks very much, and thank you all for being on the call. And I look forward to your questions. Of course, we all come to this question with our own personal experiences, and that, of course, includes Secretary Kerry. It includes Martin Indyk, who's one of his chief advisors and who worked on this so much in the Clinton administration. I was reminded as I was thinking about this call of a line in my book, and it comes from August 2008, when Secretary Rice, Condi Rice, is trying to promote an Israeli-Palestinian peace deal, just as Secretary Kerry is now. And she's talking to President Abbas, who then is now president of the Palestinian Authority and the key person the Israelis are negotiating with. And he is saying to her that he really doesn't have any hope of reaching an agreement by the end of that year. Here's the line from my book. But Rice had not given up on getting a document. I may be the last person on the planet who thinks an agreement is still possible, but I do, she told Abbas with a smile. I was thinking about that because it occurred to me, I wonder if John Kerry is the last person on the planet now who thinks an agreement is possible. He does seem to think some kind of agreement is possible, and he's continuing to push for it. And we can ask the question, of course, why? And he gave us a good insight into his thinking recently, just a few weeks ago, actually, February 3rd, when he said, speaking in Munich at the Security Conference, quote, today's status quo absolutely, to a certainty, I promise you 100%, cannot be maintained. It's not sustainable. It's illusionary. So in his view, the current situation, though it may appear to be stable, isn't. And it will change very likely for the worse for the Israelis and Palestinians. So he's trying very hard to get some kind of a deal. I don't think that a final status agreement, which was the original goal, that is a comprehensive permanent peace deal, is at this point Secretary's goal and the goal of Martin Indyk and the rest of the people involved. I think they realize that there is no chance to do that in short order, that is to say in the 9 months that the administration originally gave it. So what are they trying to get? They've begun to use the word framework, a framework agreement, and that would be, of course, not a comprehensive agreement that spelled out in detail solutions to all of the many problems. It would assert some principles. It would be a little bit more reminiscent perhaps, of the Clinton parameters or of the roadmap in the Bush administration in setting forth a general outline of what something would look like. And the purpose of that framework agreement, I think, is to keep everyone negotiating. That is, the short-term goal, it seems to me, is not to let things collapse in the way that they once collapsed after Camp David, and there was violence. So the goal now, I think, is to produce a document that both sides, Israelis and Palestinians, can say, well, we don't like all of it, we take exception to certain parts of it, but we accept the document, generally speaking, as a basis to continue negotiating. That, I think, is the Secretary's goal right now. Getting there is not going to be easy. Even the more limited goal of a framework agreement, because all of the old issues that have always been so difficult are still there and remain difficult. Borders, Jerusalem, security, refugees, settlements. And to that you can add a new problem, new in the sense of the last 6 or 7 years, Gaza. That is, what do you do about the fact that Gaza is not under the control of the Palestinian Authority and the PLO? There was another neuralgic issue that we didn't hear as much about in the Clinton or Bush years, and that is the Israeli desire that there be a Palestinian admission that Israel's a Jewish state. Now, both sides are going to have to make some kind of compromise to even agree to a framework agreement. Tzipi Livni recently said, frankly, I don't think we're going to be in love with this paper, but I hope that we can live with this paper, and I'm sure this also applies to the Palestinian side. And I think that's right, that both sides are going to have to swallow hard. The Palestinian negotiator, Saab Erekat, said on the 4th, so that's 3 weeks ago, that his most recent meeting with the Secretary of State had made no progress, and he was very emphatic on the Jewish state. And he told Livni when they met in Munich at that same security symposium, quote, I told her in front of the whole world that we will not change our history, our religion, or our civilization. We are the lawful sons of Palestine. We will not accept Israel as a Jewish state. So that's a significant problem. One place where Secretary Kerry has been working very hard is on the security side. And you will have read things about the Jordan Valley and his efforts to come up with a compromise where Israeli troops can stay there for a certain number of years, and then maybe there's some kind of international force. They're trying to come up with a compromise formulation that, again, that Israelis and Palestinians can live with enough to continue and stay at the table. And again, I think that's the short-term goal here. First, keep the negotiations going with some kind of document. And once that's achieved, then you may have another 6 or 12 months to try to get into the more fundamental problems, such as Jerusalem. I think I'll stop with that just as an outline. As you can hear from what I've said, I'm on the skeptical side as to what we're going to be able to achieve, we the United States are going to be able to achieve here, but I'm very happy to talk about it further. So let me stop at that point. Thank you.
Elliot, thanks very much. Let's open it up to the group for questions.
Thank you. At this time, we open the floor for questions. If you would like to ask a question, please press the star key, followed by the one key on your touch-tone phone now. Questions will be taken in the order in which they are received. If at any time you would like to ask a question or remove yourself from the questioning queue, please press star 2. Again, to ask a question, please press star 1 now. Our first question will come from Robert Smith with the Evangelical Lutheran Church America.
Mr. Abrams, thank you very much for this brief summary of your views of the current negotiation process. I think many would agree with you that any framework agreement that comes out will be difficult for all sides to swallow. I'm looking at the policy innovation memorandum that was sent out in the invitations to this call, and I'm seeing that you're advocating that the United States aim lower than simply achieving a comprehensive political agreement. But I also notice that part of your strong emphasis here is to strengthen the Palestinian Authority against Hamas. And I'm wondering what you see as the barriers or the why it is not advisable to bring further unity in Palestinian political life rather than increasing division for the long term.
Thank you. Well, first let me say you certainly read that policy innovation memorandum right. And what I was trying to convey there is that it is not necessarily the case that by trying to leap ahead to a comprehensive agreement, you get closer to a comprehensive agreement. I think there's a good argument to make that you need to build the institutions of a Palestinian state from the bottom up. That seems like it's a much longer way to get to the goal. But, of course, we've been trying to get to this goal for a very long time, certainly you would have to say since Camp David. I think if we had done more from the bottom up, we'd be closer to it, the goal being the two-state solution. I think the problem on Palestinian unity is that Hamas is not willing to commit itself in any way to the goals that we have and that we generally share with the Israelis and with the Palestinian Authority and PLO. That is, PLO has made agreements with Israel since the Oslo Accords. They are, in our view, generally binding on both parties, and they lead toward Palestinian statehood. And that's the goal that Israel, the Palestinian Authority, and the United States, and for that matter others, I mean the European Union, the UN, Russia, which is a member of the quartet, have adopted the two-state solution. Hamas is not committed to that goal. It's not committed to the goal of building a Palestinian state, even on the full 1967 borders, a state that would live at peace with its neighbor Israel. It's not committed to maintaining and respecting the agreements that have been signed by the PLO in past years with Israel. So the idea is, and this was, I think, true of the Clinton and Bush as well as the Obama administrations, is that because Hamas is not committed to those goals, bringing Hamas in, Palestinian unity in that sense, doesn't get us closer to peace. It brings into the Palestinian political system a force that is committed to destroying the state of Israel. If you look at the Hamas charter, which remains unchanged, it's a really astonishing document, which is really full of venomous anti-Semitism, protocols of the Elders of Zion. I mean, it's got the whole nine yards. That's really been the view of the United States for a very long time, that what we need is for people who seek peace with Israel, Palestinians who seek peace with Israel, to lead in that direction. We need Israelis, of course, to meet them halfway. The inclusion of Hamas would set back the cause of peace by bringing to the table a party that is not seeking peace.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question will come from Ronald Sider with Evangelicals for Social Action.
My question, thank you very much, Mr. Abrams. My question is, what role do you think going forward evangelical Protestants in the U.S. Will play, and what do you think they ought to play?
Well, they ought to play the same role, I guess, that you know that any American citizen group should play, which is it's certainly legitimate to press your views on the U.S. government and ask the government to do what you think is right from the point of view of policy, support Israel more or less, the PA more or less, push for whatever goals you think there are. Now, generally, I think one can say that the evangelical community as a whole has been very pro-Israel. Of course, there are divisions, as there are in any large community. But the bulk of evangelical political presence, I would say, in Congress, for example, has been to support the administration's general support for Israel and to ask for more of it. That is, the criticisms from many evangelical groups have been that the administration has been insufficiently supportive of Israel, has been in the UN, been too tough on Israel in bilateral relations, has asked Israel for too many concessions as part of the Kerry negotiations. So, again, I understand the evangelical community is divided, but I think it's fair to make that generalization, that even the evangelicals have become a very important base of support for Israel, particularly in Congress. You could say second only to the American Jewish community, and you might even say foremost, even more important than the American Jewish community, only because there are so many more voters among evangelicals. Did I answer your question? Or
Yes, in part. What I would add is that I think there's major change going on, that the younger evangelicals, especially millennials, are moving rather quickly to a much more we're equally concerned with Israel and Palestine, and I think that will have an effect.
Yes, I know there's a debate in the evangelical community over this, and of course numbers are hard to come by with respect to where is the balance of opinion, and to what degree is this a generational question, to what degree is this a left-right political question. But it's a very important question because the evangelical community is so large and has been over the last, 25 years, so much a key pillar of support of Israel.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Again, as a reminder, if you would like to ask a question, please press the star key followed by the one key on your touch-tone phone. Our next question will come from Will McGarvey with the Interfaith Council of Contra Costa County.
Thanks so much for the briefing today. I have a couple questions. I'm wondering if the negotiations are including conversations around holy sites and access, especially with some of the protests going on near the Al-Aqsa Mosque and the tensions rising there. And I'm interested in what your views are around Israel's seemingly changing policy around it being more inclusive of Christians than Muslims into the army inside Israel proper.
Yeah, thanks. If you're discussing Jerusalem or the West Bank, you've got to be discussing the holy sites. It's a really neuralgic point. I mean, in the West Bank, you've got a place like Hebron, which has a small community of Jewish settlers, and you know what happens to them. What happens? How is the site protected? How do you protect Jewish, particularly Jewish access, after you've established a Palestinian state with full sovereignty? And of course, Jerusalem, even more of a tough issue because you've got sites. First of all, you've got sites outside the old city. You've got sites inside the old city, the Temple Mount being the most critical one. And the difficulty there is, first, it's very hard to figure out how to make it work between the Israelis and Palestinians. But second, it's not just an Israeli-Palestinian issue. It's also a more general Islamic issue. There is a Jordanian role in the protection of the holy sites, of the Muslim holy sites, in the old city. And that is actually enshrined in the Israeli-Jordanian peace treaty, that there'd be a Jordanian role. And so whenever you see, for example, violence in the last day or two on the Temple Mount, you will hear a comment from Jordan, and you will see sometimes public but sometimes private conversations between Israel and Jordan about this. And, of course, it also involves other Muslim countries. When Olmert, in 2008, made his proposal for the governing of the Old City, he wanted to include not only Jordan but Saudi Arabia as the country that has also protection of the of Mecca and Medina. I remember a conversation with an Arab foreign minister that I had where we were talking about borders, the border issue between Israel and Palestine, and he shook his head and said to me, I'm not interested in that. I'm not in the real estate business. What I'm interested in is Jerusalem. And I think you would find that among a number of Muslim leaders around the world. So it makes it even more complicated. It has to be on the agenda. Unless, and one of the ways you can handle this, frankly, if there is a framework agreement, is you punt, you kick it down the road. And this is what may well happen. That is that the section on Jerusalem says everybody agrees that the holy sites must be protected and people of all faiths must have equal and easy access to the holy sites, you know, phrases like that that don't actually get you further than we have been in the past. They don't actually represent progress because the issues are so hard. They're just saved for later. You know, it's funny in the context of your comment about Christian and Muslim service in the army, that Israel, of course, is in the middle of a debate about Jewish service in the army. The ultra-Orthodox have been exempt since the founding of the State of Israel, and there's such a large portion of the population now that there's a bill that just passed the Knesset and that is law now that will, over the next few years, call for drafting significant numbers of ultra-Orthodox young men for the army. There is a bill now that distinguishes between Christian and Muslim Israelis. There is a movement, and I can't gauge how large it is in the Israeli Christian community, in which some Christian Arabs have said, we want to serve in the army and we should not be exempt from service. Druze, by the way, have never been exempt and have served largely in the border police. I think it's going to be hard for Israel to make this distinction between, let's say, among Arab Israelis, some of whom are Christian and most of whom are Muslim, about service in the army by law. It seems to me it would be a lot easier for them, if they want more Christians in the army, simply to encourage that. They've had a problem of excluding Arabs from the draft, and this is really part of a deeper issue on the relationship of non-Jewish Israelis to support of the state. And in fact, it is even part of an even deeper issue of the relationship of citizens to the state, because there are some, I don't want to use a label like extreme, but let's say ultra-Orthodox Jewish groups that have a kind of indifferent attitude of with respect to supporting the state of Israel.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question will come from Doug Hofstetter with the Mennonite Central Community.
Thank you very much, Dr. Abrams, for this presentation. I just came back from a couple weeks in the West Bank, Gaza, and Israel, and none of the Palestinians that I talked to felt like continuing negotiations was a viable option for them. They have looked at the history of all of the negotiations that have happened so far, and as the negotiations have continued, they have seen their lands, their rights, and everything disappear. The one other statement that you made when talking about how the negotiation is leading towards a two-state solution. Once again, from all of the Palestinians, both Muslim and Christian, that I spent time with, they probably feel like they are further from a two-state solution than they were in 1967. They have fewer rights than they did in right after the Israeli conquest. All of the supposed rights that they thought they had negotiated in Oslo have all disappeared, and none of them feel like this is moving towards a situation where they would end up with a Palestinian state. Now, it was interesting, the Jewish colleagues that I spoke with were much more optimistic that the framework would be significant and that it would be a watershed and present some real challenges to the Israeli government and perhaps to the future of the region. But I don't think I met a single Palestinian that felt that way.
Well, thanks. It's very interesting. I'm surprised by one thing you said, which is the optimism among Jewish Israelis. In my visits there, I have found very little optimism about the current negotiation. You know, it makes me think when Sharon said he was going to get out of Gaza, there were giant demonstrations against it. I remember one demonstration of 120,000 people, which is huge, especially for Israel. It's not that big a country. And I think the reason for the demonstration was that people actually believed that Sharon was going to get out of Gaza if they didn't stop him, which he did do. Now you don't see demonstrations, and I think the reason you don't is that people don't think anything is going to come of this negotiation. They're not, depending obviously on their political view of this, but they're not afraid. They hear talk of all sorts of things that they may not like, but they don't actually believe that it is going to lead to anything happening on the ground. Therefore, why go out and demonstrate against it? I haven't found much optimism on either side, Israeli or Palestinian. Now, one of the problems with this, you know, people sometimes say, "What? So what's the downside?" I mean, you try to negotiate, and you get as far as you can. There is no downside, but there are downsides, and one of them is that you create a certain cynicism among Israelis and Palestinians with respect to the whole negotiating process. It seems like a never-ending fraud. On and on it goes, no matter who's president of the United States, yet it never actually achieves the two-state solution. That's why in the policy innovation memorandum, I urge that we try things that are more pragmatic and that affect actually the way people live. Now, I do think there have been some changes. I mean, obviously, there was a big change when the Israelis got out of Gaza. All settlers and Israeli military are out of Gaza. I think if you go take the last few years, let's say the years of Netanyahu and Obama as leaders, so 5 years, there's more mobility in the West Bank, certainly than there was in the previous years. There are fewer obstacles and checkpoints than there were prior to that. There are more West Bank Palestinians working in Israel now, many more than there were 5 years ago. There are now tens of thousands working there. There have been some other moves that have been made, like permitting Israeli Arabs to go into the West Bank to shop, which may seem minor, but economically it's very useful for the West Bank economy, because Israeli Arabs have more money. All of these things have happened in the last 5 years. It's certainly true that conditions deteriorated if you're comparing them to 1967. Because immediately after 67, there was really no border between the West Bank and Israel. People just moved back and forth. Israelis and Palestinians moved back and forth pretty freely. But the intifadas put paid to that. So I don't think that's a fair comparison. I think the question, my own view is, that the question now, whether this framework agreement happens and people agree to a document and agree to continue negotiating or not, my view is that more attention needs to be paid to life on the ground. That is to say, how Palestinians actually live from one day to the next. For example, the mobility question. The question of reducing to an absolute minimum the number of Israeli obstacles and checkpoints in the West Bank, the number of Israeli military raids in the West Bank. I don't think you'll get to zero, but the question is whether every raid is absolutely necessary or Palestinian police security officers could take care of that particular problem. The question of Palestinian autonomy in greater areas of the West Bank. I also say in that memorandum that I don't think it's politically realistic to believe that there would be a freeze on Israeli settlement construction in the major blocks, but I think it is realistic to think about a freeze beyond the security barrier in the smaller settlements in areas that are very heavily populated by Palestinians. These are things that I think would have an immediate impact on Palestinian life, and they'd be visible to Palestinians. And they would think that, you know, well, whether statehood is closer or not, life is actually improving. And the problem with going always for the, you know, the handshakes on the White House lawn is that if you fail, you've got nothing. Whereas if you're trying to, for example, if you're trying to eliminate 20 Israeli barriers to mobility in the West Bank, and you don't fully succeed, maybe you only get rid of 10, well, for the people who use those 10 roads or who live near those 10 villages, that's a visible improvement in their lives. And I think it would be useful for us to concentrate on that. It is not a substitute for the political negotiation. It is not a substitute for the efforts of the United States and others to get to the two-state solution. But no one can tell us when we're going to achieve that. You know, we've been trying for decades. And meanwhile, people have to live, Israelis and Palestinians, which is why I think we need to right the balance here and concentrate more on pragmatic steps that will improve the way people are actually living.
Thank you. Next question or comment.
Thank you. Again, if you would like to ask a question, please press the star key followed by the one key on your touch-tone phone. Our next question will come from Dwayne Larson with the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America.
Thank you very much, Dr. Evans, for sharing your expertise with us. My question happens to follow up, I think quite aptly, on what you just shared with us. There is, of course, a long-term perception of imbalance on the part of the U.S. brokering team. And two factors of late might lend all the more to that perception, warranted or not. One of them being Secretary Kerry's appointment of David Makovsky to the peace team. He has, as you know, at least in Palestinian eyes, a reputation for designing maps that support extreme Likud visions of borders. And your own very fine pragmatic article, with which I find myself mostly in agreement, and you write very aptly about penalization, appropriately, for activities that Palestinians might engage in that, of course, are taking of life and other forms of violence. Interestingly, the language of penalization is not used with respect to egregious activities from the Israeli side. And, of course, any partisan will find excuses to and cherry-picking to deny the prospects of peacemaking with the other. I wonder if you might say some more, not only about incremental effects for which we can hope on the ground, but some more about how the United States can cultivate a wider and deeper sense of trust, particularly from the Palestinians, as to U.S. leadership.
Thanks. Thanks. It's a very, you know, it's an interesting question. Let me say on the personnel side, you know, David Makovsky, whom I know, I'm surprised to hear those you know, his efforts described as sort of related to the Likud view, because I actually don't think that's his view, and I think that people on the right in Israel would are unhappy with his constant efforts to figure out ways of moving the peace process forward. And, you know, I've seen in the last day or two complaints about the appointment of Rob Malley to a position at the National Security Council. He worked at the NSC, actually in the Clinton administration, and was at Camp David, part of those negotiations. And you have some Jewish groups saying that they're very disappointed with his appointment because he's not viewed as sufficiently sympathetic with Israel. I think both of those are perfectly good appointments. Clearly, in an issue this sensitive, people at that level are not making policy. This is really one where the president and the Secretary of State make policy. And so I don't share the worry about Makovsky. I don't share the worry about Malley. And I think if people have a complaint, whether it's that we're, you know, we're not pro-Israel enough, we're too pro-Israel, we're too pro-Palestinian, we all need to direct our compliments or complaints to Obama and Kerry, just as we needed to direct them to, you know, Clinton and Albright and to Bush and Rice. This issue is really controlled very, very high up, I think. Now, I have been struck when I was in the Bush administration. I think it's fair to say we had a pretty good degree of confidence from both sides, from the Israelis and the Palestinians. President got along quite well. If you go to the end with Olmert, this is his second term, with Olmert and with Abbas. He didn't get along well with Arafat, but he certainly got along well with Abbas. I don't think President Obama has a good relationship, really a very good relationship with either of them. I have the impression Secretary Kerry has a better relationship with both of them, that is, with Netanyahu and Abbas. But I do think the level of the personal relationship has been better. It was better, and this, I hope this isn't viewed as a partisan comment. It was certainly a very good relationship under President Clinton, but it's lost something now, and both sides seem to feel unhappy and disappointed with Washington. I don't think it's going to be possible, frankly, to restore much of that with the president, in the sense that, you know, Netanyahu and Abbas and Obama have been dealing with each other for 5 years. That's a long time, and they have formed opinions of each other. And I don't see what's going to happen in the next couple of years that's going to lead any of the three of them significantly to change his opinion of the others. So in a certain sense, Secretary Kerry has to work around that. Now, there's a broader question that you raise of American, you know, the perception of the American role. The one perception that is certainly right is that the United States is the most influential foreign actor when it comes to the Israelis. So if you're Palestinian, then you're asking yourself, who is going to push the Israelis in my direction? Who is going to pressure them on points that are tough for them? The answer is the United States. You know, it's not Europe, it's not the UN, it's not Russia, it's the Americans. And all Palestinians understand that. It's at the popular level, we're not popular at all. That is, the United States is not. There's a new Pew poll this week that shows that. And here the Palestinians are not an anomaly. We're very unpopular in Jordan, too. It's interesting because we have terrific relations between the United States and Jordan. Terrific relationship between the king and President Obama. We have terrific military and intelligence relationships, but the people of Jordan have a pretty dim opinion of the United States, and so do the people of Palestine. I don't think there's anything we're going to be able to do about that in the short run. in the short run, meaning, let's say, the Obama years, three more years, the question is whether the United States, primarily through Secretary Kerry, can maintain a good working relationship with both sides and have an influence on Abbas and his team and Netanyahu and his team. I think the answer to that is yes, because we are still the most influential outside actor, and both Israelis and Palestinians, I think, recognize that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Again, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your touch-tone phone. Our next question will come from Shaikh Ubaid with the Muslim Peace Coalition. Shaikh, go ahead with your question. All right, I believe he may have disconnected. And Ms. Vasquez, it looks like we have no further questions at this time.
All right. Well, Elliot, is there anything you've given us a really terrific overview and forecast of what to look for? Are there any closing remarks you'd like to make?
Yes. One piece of good news, I think, is the unlikelihood of significant outbreak of violence. I don't think that's going to happen. And I say that partly because Palestinians, I believe, concluded, both at the elite level, at the government level, and at the popular level, that the last outbreak of violence after Camp David was really harmful to Palestinians. It was harmful politically, it was harmful personally, it was harmful in every way. And certainly that's the conclusion of President Abbas, who's simply against violence. I mean, he made that very clear from the day that he became prime minister in 2003. So the Palestinian Authority is going to do whatever it can, even if these talks break down completely, which I don't think will happen. But even if they break down completely, I don't think you'll see a significant amount of violence because the Palestinian Authority is against it and will try to prevent it. My own guess is that the talks won't break down. That is, I think it's likely that Secretary Kerry will succeed in getting both sides to agree, grudgingly perhaps, to some document. And, you know, if you go back to the roadmap, both sides agreed to proceed on the basis of the roadmap. Both sides had objections. Sharon, at that time, stated his objections in writing and gave them to the U.S. And I think you'll see something like that, both sides saying, well, this document leaves a lot to be desired. We can't quite agree with all of it. However, we'll stay at the table. I think that's the most likely outcome. And just to repeat myself, I hope that as we go forward at the negotiating level, that we also have a team that's working on ways of moving forward at the pragmatic level of day-to-day life and day-to-day interactions between Israelis and Palestinians, because though it is our policy to promote a two-state solution, no one has any idea when that will occur, and it can be a long time. So I hope that in the interim, we focus a good deal of attention on improving life for Israelis and Palestinians, and building now the institutions of a Palestinian state so that whenever that day comes that there's a signature, they're really ready to take over. In Gaza, that did not happen. When the Israelis left, the institutions were not there really to govern well. And the lesson I think we should learn from that is that now is the time when we should be helping more, dedicating more efforts to the building of those institutions and building toward the two-state solution, even though we don't know when that day comes. Thank you all very much for being on the call.
Elliot, actually, are you still there?
Yes.
We have just a couple more questions that have popped up, so we have just
okay.
a little bit more time. So if you are,
sure.
are amenable, I'd like to try to get a couple more.
Yep.
All right, thank you. Our next question will come from Gilbert Rosenthal with the National Council of Synagogues.
Thank you for your briefing, sir. What do you think of Ambassador Oren's plan that that if the talks break down, Israel should unilaterally remove itself from the West Bank and essentially yield the governance of the West Bank to Abbas and the PLO?
Well, now, let me just make it clear, I'm speaking only for myself here. This is not a Council on Foreign Relations view. I'm generally speaking in agreement with Ambassador Oren. What he's proposing is what Prime Minister Olmert proposed when, after Sharon's strokes, he ran for office himself in 2006. He called it Hitkansut, or something like convergence, or meaning that he would he ran on the platform that he would try to negotiate an agreement, and if he couldn't negotiate something, he would essentially unilaterally pull back toward the security barrier that had been built. I believe, after talking to lots of people who were associated with Ariel Sharon, who worked for him and his government, that after Gaza, it was actually his intention to do something like that. That is, move out of the smaller settlements that are so difficult to defend from a military point of view, which was a point of view, of course, that Sharon had, and that was one of the key considerations he had in mind for Gaza. I think that it would be advantageous for Israel to see the security barrier, which takes about 12% of the West Bank, as a temporary or interim border, because if you believe in the two-state solution, then sooner or later those areas beyond the security fence are going to be Palestine. And the only thing that's being negotiated is the area that's within the security fence. How much of that is Israel going to keep? How much of it will be Palestine? How much of it will Israel keep? But there will be land swaps so that the area of Palestine is not diminished. So I'm basically in accord with Ambassador Oren on that.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. And one final question.
Thank you. Our last question will come from Richard Fulton with the AJC.
Hi, Elliot. Hope good to hear you. I wanted to ask, and I called in late, so if you've covered this, please forgive me. But you alluded to the fact that the Palestinians naturally look to the United States as the ones who can pressure Israel to move in the direction they want it to go. Who's out there in the international world who could and should be pressuring the Palestinians to move in a more realistic direction in terms of making the kinds of compromises that will lead to the minimum that Israel could accept? And is anybody, in fact, who falls in that camp actually doing that at this point?
Well, one of the reasons that the United States – let me say first, hello, Richard. Thank you for the question. One of the reasons the United States is so influential is the military aid relationship with Israel, a relationship that's really irreplaceable, even though Israel has military relationships with a number of other countries. Chancellor Merkel of Germany has just been visiting Israel, and they're a military partner of Israel as well. On the Palestinian side, one can look to aid donors. Who has influence in Ramallah? Well, the United States does, and one of the reasons for that is that we are the most generous aid donor. They also get significant amounts of aid from the European Union and the member states in Europe and from Arab oil exporters. So outside of the United States, if you're looking for people who can have real influence in Ramallah, it's Saudi Arabia, the Emirates, and the key European countries and the EU. And there has not been a willingness. There has been a willingness to press on some things and not on others. Just to give you an example, right now, most observers would say, including a lot of Palestinian observers, corruption is spreading. Corruption is spreading in the Palestinian Authority, particularly since the departure of Prime Minister Salam Fayyad last year. Well, nobody's really exercising pressure to prevent that or to diminish that. I don't know how much longer that can go on, because I have heard some speeches in Europe where people are kind of fed up with that. They thought it was going down, now it's going up again. They, like we, have very difficult fiscal times and compressed foreign aid budgets. So you may see some pressure on Europe on the corruption question. You haven't seen it yet. On the incitement question, that is glorification of terrorism and terrorists in official media. So we're not talking about censorship here. We're talking about official Palestinian Authority media. Again, the neither the Europeans nor the Arab states, and here I'd have to add, nor the United States, have really exercised significant pressure. The reason for it, I think, is easy to see. The Palestinian Authority frequently is living hand-to-mouth and can't pay the payroll, for example, school teachers, hospitals. And so people are reluctant to withhold money and weaken the Palestinian Authority when it cannot meet its payroll. But if we get past this moment of a framework agreement so that we know we're heading for another year of negotiations, then I think that's something that we should aid donors, the U.S., the EU, the Arab states should think about is whether there are things the Palestinian Authority is doing that should change, and that would make peace more likely, and that would make the building of a Palestinian state more likely. On the statehood question, there is a corruption issue. On the peace issue, there is what is generally called incitement, but what really means the glorification, the awarding of medals, the naming of schools and parks for people who have actually committed acts of terrorism, frequently murderous acts of terrorism, and, you know, the message that conveys to the next generation of Palestinians. That hasn't been happening. We give it lip service here in the U.S. Every president does, every Secretary of State does. But we don't actually put much pressure on, no matter who's president, whichever party is in power. And that's something I think we should be thinking more about.
Thank you, Elliot. I really appreciate your taking the time to do this, as does the group. And thanks to all of you for your questions. We appreciate your joining us today as well.
Thanks, everybody.
Our next call will be on Thursday. Actually, we'll be sending you information about our next call, but I just wanted to flag for you that our friends at the Institute for Global Engagement will be hosting a discussion on women of faith featuring Catherine Marshall. If you're interested in participating, please email lkuntz@globalengage.org. And that discussion via conference call is taking place on Thursday, March 6th at 1 p.m. Again, please email us if you have any suggestions or comments at outreach@cfr.org, and we look forward to your continued participation.
Thank you for listening to this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. For additional audio, video, and transcripts of CFR meetings, as well as expert analysis of international news, please visit us online, cfr.org.